This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we will look back to last year's presidential election and the controversy over Florida. And our guests for the program is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He also is a legal analyst at ABC, and he's written a number of other books, including A Vast Conspiracy, The Real Story of the Sex Scandal That Nearly Brought Down a President, and The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. The new book, Too Close to Call, out now, just recently published by Random House, available in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome. All you need to do to be a part of the conversation is to call in. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things going and get as many different people as possible. Anyone's invited to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Match the letters and the numbers. You get WILL 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Toobin, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's our pleasure.
We appreciate it. I'm interested in your reaction to the most recent news on this that came out a couple of weeks ago. The consortium of news organizations that came together to look at the ballots, and among them, the Washington Post. I'm not sure who all else was involved.
Associated Press, New York Times. It was sort of all the big
the big guys. The bottom line being, as I understood it, what they concluded was that if the partial recount that was going on had been allowed to continue, then President Bush would have prevailed. Mr. Bush would have prevailed. However, there's still some open question about what would have happened if there had been a recount of the entire state. And in that case, I'm not sure what the bottom line is, whether people are saying it could have gone one way or the other, or that there was a little edge to Mr. Gore. I don't know.
Well, I think you got it about half right.
Okay.
I think if the limited recount had gone forward, the conclusion is that Bush would have won. If a complete recount had gone forward, Gore would have won. Each conclusion is as definitive as the other.
Okay.
And I think it really underlines one of the sort of points that I make in the book, and one of the sort of key strategic errors in Gore's strategy, which is not to seek a full recount from the very beginning.
Well, that is one of the big and very interesting questions when you look at the strategy that the two sides followed. Why it is that the Gore team did not say, well, heck, let's go ahead and count all the votes.
Well, I think that really goes to the heart of sort of who Al Gore is and what kind of campaign for president he ran. He very much is and was a creature of Washington, someone very worried about what was written, say, on the New York Times editorial page. And in that world, there was an immediate consensus that the public was very impatient with this whole process, that it had to be wrapped up quickly in a matter of days, and that So Gore was very concerned with asking for the most limited recount, not sort of throwing open the whole election. This and thus he only asked for the recount in four counties. This has now proved to be wrong on several different levels. First of all, and I think perhaps most importantly, is that it was wrong about the public mood. The public was not terribly impatient about this process. They were happy to see the votes counted. There was a president. No one particularly cared whether the Secretary of Agriculture was named on November 30th or December 30th. And so there was considerable patience. Second, Gore looked, understandably, like he was just cherry-picking the good Democratic counties, not seeking a relatively unbiased full recount. So politically, it was a false move for him. And finally, I mean, as this recount shows, he just would have been better off as a candidate if he had sought the full recount. So it was kind of the original sin of the Gore recount effort just 2 days after the election.
Mm. It certainly is. It goes without saying that the tone of the campaign is shaped by the personality of the candidates. And you've talked a little bit here about how the Florida battle of this, what happened after the election on the Democratic side, was indeed shaped by, influenced by the personality of Mr. Gore. Can one say the same sort of thing on the other side, that the tactics that the Republicans employed were shaped somehow, influenced by the personality of Mr. Bush.
Very much so. And in fact, I think informs some things that we can learn about what the Bush presidency has been like. There was not a great concern in the Bush team about elite opinion. There was concern about mass opinion. There was not a great deal of concern about process. There was concern about results. George W. Bush largely left the mechanics of the recount to James Baker, and Baker saw this process as not just legal, but political, public relations. You know, one of the key differences between the two sides was that in the days immediately after the election, Al Gore called Jesse Jackson, who was starting to organize protests in West Palm Beach, and he said, "No, I don't want to. I don't want you to be protesting. I see this as a legal process, not a political process. So I want you to stop it." Baker, on the other hand, said, I do want protesters in the streets. I do want people organized. I want governors down here to be surrogates for Bush." I mean, he saw it much more as a full court press, and I think that had a lot to do with the result.
Mm. Well, that gets at another question, and perhaps we've talked about that a little bit already, but I'm also interested in how you feel that the personalities of the two men who were chosen by the campaigns to lead the effort in Florida, that is Mr. Baker and for the Democrats, Warren Christopher, how that choice perhaps also shaped the strategies the two sides employed.
Warren Christopher was sort of the Democratic symbol of the Washington establishment, even though he's from Los Angeles, is that he was sort of the sober former Secretary of State, lawyer. Importantly, he was not someone who knew much of anything about politics. He was also, and I think it's significant, he was not a young 75 years old, and he was just not ready to wade into the muck of a detailed recount. And he sort of made a brief appearance in Tallahassee, but then he was gone. James Baker, and this is as someone who was in Tallahassee the whole time, as I was, it was very striking to see that Baker was there the whole time. I mean, Baker was literally in charge of this operation, and his commitment and his energy played an enormous role in how this story played out. I think, you know, as an author, perhaps the most interesting character to me was Bill Daley, who was Gore's campaign chairman. And, you know, he, of course, is the son of Boss Daley, who, as Illinois listeners will know, is the folklore has it that he's the guy who stole the 1960 election for John F. Kennedy. Probably not true, but that certainly is the mythology. And here was his son coming to Florida. Now, Republicans made a great deal of this, saying, look, another Daley is stealing the election. But, in fact, Bill Daley was the chief advocate in the Gore camp of surrender. He was the one who wanted to basically give up from the very beginning. And I just thought that was an interesting twist on what you might expect.
Mm-hmm. Was that because he was, like a lot of people said, well, maybe we just ought to forget this one and preserve whatever political capital you, Mr. Gore, have for a future run, and say, we'll let go this time and we'll say we'll get him another day?
Well, I think possibly that, but also I think he, you know, unlike his father, Bill Daley is very much a creature of the establishment. You know, his big cause in the Clinton administration was NAFTA. The North American Free Trade Agreement. He was the Secretary of Commerce, the representative of big business. He was not a guy who was a political street fighter. So, yes, I just think it was easier for him to say let's give up, when in fact it was when you know people on the other side were just beginning to fight.
Our guest this morning is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, also legal analyst at ABC, and author of several books, and his most recent is about the 2000 election, specifically about the battle in Florida last fall. The title is Too Close to Call. It's published by Random House. We have some callers here to bring into the conversation, and let us do that, starting with someone in Northern Illinois, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I was always concerned about what were the consequences of the Supreme Court decision, because I remember Linda Greenhouse was on Washington Week after the decision, and she looked in shock. She looked like she couldn't believe it. And prior to that, there were a lot of legal analysts saying the Supreme Court was not going to get involved. And so now many people see it as a very partisan, applying only to that election, no other civil rights involved. So what about in the legal community? Do they just shrug it off, or does it have consequences?
Well, my favorite quote about the Supreme Court is from Justice Robert Jackson, who said, we are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final. In other words, the Supreme Court is going to be there forever. They are the last word in our society, and there's just nothing anybody can do about it. But, I mean, as I write in Too Close to Call, I mean, I think the decision is nearly indefensible. And particularly, you put your finger on one of the key parts of the decision where they say, in this especially explicit way, that, well, we don't regard this decision as a precedent for anyone else. It's just a benefit, you know, it just has one beneficiary. Now, in a court that's supposed to establish rules of general application, that's a pretty shameful way to make decisions, but it's what the Supreme Court did here, and I think they did some damage to their reputations, but I don't think the Supreme Court is any less has any less authority as a result.
And one of the things you mentioned is that the Washington establishment and the news media seem to be, the American people will not stand for this delay, you know, a recount, that it would be terrible. And they were practically predicting people in the streets. And the American public sort of said, well, okay, sure, recount, you know, no big deal. And also they seem to be saying that about during the impeachment, about, you know, not wanting Clinton to resign, they seem to be saying, well, yeah, you know, sure, let there be an impeachment. You know, we're not going to go in the streets and say Clinton has to resign. And you can see it now with the military tribunals, and very few people are saying, wow, you know, military tribunals, no secret courts, secret military courts. And I sometimes think, when would the American people say, wow, this is bad?
Well, you know, I wrote a book called The Vast Conspiracy about the Clinton's impeachment, and one of the striking things about it was that the people in Washington thought the public would be really outraged at Clinton for what he did, and I think people out there in the real world had a fairly realistic assessment that was very unhysterical and sort of amused, but did not regard his conduct as a firing offense. I think there was a similar misimpression of the public mood in this story, that the sense that the public would be so outraged by the recount. You know, I think the simple Gore appeal of counting all the votes had a lot of appeal and still does. And I think the Supreme Court, by short-circuiting that vote count, really did itself a lot of institutional damage. But, you know, I think basically responses to this story broke down along party lines. The Democrats were outraged and Republicans weren't. And you know, life went on, and people's views were more or less what they had always been.
Okay. Last thing is, I wrote you a letter during the impeachment when you were on ABC News, and I realize now I was wrong, because what you were saying was, well, you know, if these charges are true, you know, it could be very serious. And the Republicans were always throwing in secrets to China, and Line is, you know, such a travesty that he has to resign. And you were really up against people who were in no way responsible, you know, like a responsible legal attitude where you would say, you know, if these are true, where the other people would always say, you know, act as if it was absolutely true, that everything Ken Starr leaked was absolutely true. And so I must say, it taught me to listen a little more carefully when responsible people are on, and I hope your book sells well.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Just to follow up real quick on this conversation about the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, do you believe that their motivation was largely partisan?
Boy, that's, you know, that is obviously a very important question, but it's also a hard question. These justices are very intelligent people, and they are not going to broadcast their motives if they are improper. I think it is safe to say that the five justices who voted for Bush in the ballot box in the polling place voted for him in court, and the four who voted for Gore wound up voting for him in the decision. You know, in Too Close to Call, I do point out that Justice O'Connor had been very outspoken in Washington social settings about her desire for Bush to win, but they all articulated legal reasons for signing on to the opinion. But I think it's highly suspicious, the majority's behavior, especially when you consider that their decision in Bush v. Gore was in some respects so counter to what they had previously expressed on issues like states' rights, like federalism, like the Equal Protection Clause. You know, you had a conservative majority that usually lets states run their own elections, that usually does not interfere in state processes, that usually does not find violations of the Equal Protection Clause, when in fact, here we had and they went back on all those apparent principles in for the beneficiary of George W. Bush.
Well, there are a lot of people who have made the criticism of the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that indeed their motivation was partisanship. And I think, though, that some people have also said perhaps there hasn't been, or perhaps you think there has been, enough parallel criticism of the Supreme Court of Florida for partisanship as well, partisanship that leaned in the other direction because the majority of the justices were Democrats.
Well, there certainly has been a lot of criticism of the Florida Supreme Court for just that reason. I guess you could criticize me for the same thing. I happen to think that the Florida Supreme Court was reflecting the principles of Florida law that said elections should be decided by the voters and you should examine the ballots to determine the intent of the voters. I mean, it's a fairly simple principle, difficult to apply. So it is certainly true that the majority in the Florida Supreme Court has been open to being attacked as partisans. I just don't happen to buy that view, but maybe that just says something about me.
Let's talk with some other callers. We have somebody in Munster, Indiana. They're next, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm really enjoying this. What do you think accounts for the negative reporting on the campaign as far as Al Gore, and on the aftermath, and even on the effects of the votes that took place? It seems very muddled, and it really seems to be negative as far as Al Gore. I mean, the Washington Post, especially C.C. Connolly, I noticed.
Well, there's a fascinating article in Rolling Stone in the current issue about press coverage of Al Gore, about kind of the folklore around him as a liar, as an exaggerator, and you know how he's, you know, claimed to have invented the internet and discovered Love Canal and all these stories that were so much. Part of the folklore of the campaign, and what the author of this story does is really debunk each one of them, and says that there was real distortion of what Gore said, and it had tremendous damage on him. And I think it's true. Now, I also think it's true that Gore himself had relatively modest political skills, and he was not a wonderful communicator, and he didn't manage to overcome these really nasty stories about him, but he got some very, very negative press coverage in this campaign, and I think it's something that we as journalists have to think about.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes.
the calling, it was titled, the court that Supreme Court docket was Gore versus Bush, but it seems to me you mentioned the Supreme Court in passing, but really what Gore's position was at the point of being argued before the court, and he should be condemned for the limited thing, and that's what everybody's talking about. If his way had been accepted, it would have been this, you know, cherry-picking thing that you referred to. But what was really overturned by the case was the Supreme Court of Florida's ruling, right? I mean,
correct, yes.
So why are people just saying, well, if Gore had gotten his way, well, that wasn't what was going to happen if the court had acted in the other way, right?
Well, this is where things get somewhat complicated. What the Florida Supreme Court ordered was a limited recount of at least the undervotes in all 67 counties where the undervotes had not been recounted. The undervotes, for a trip down memory lane, undervotes are ballots where no presidential preference was indicated, neither Bush nor Gore. What is unclear is whether the Florida Supreme Court order asked counties to review the overvotes as well, which is ballots where more than one presidential candidate was indicated. If overvotes were included, Bush would have lost. If overvotes were excluded, Gore would have lost. So depending on what you do with the overvotes, it depends on who determines who wins the election.
Okay, well, that's the first time I've ever heard that explained that clearly. But it always seemed to me that people were saying, well, if Gore got his way, but...
Well, it is true that if Gore got his way and just the four counties were recounted,
right.
He would have lost under any scenario. But as for the full statewide recount, that's where the overvote and the undervote become important.
So I thought it was that the case that actually they did it in like how many different alternative assessments? I guess it's all laid out.
Under any scenario, that my thing is true, because they did do different standards, you know, one
wing out
off, you know. Dimple chads, pregnant chads. Under all those scenarios, my conclusions hold.
Well, the other thing, just to dredge up, you know, go down memory lane, is it's just, to me, what is astounding is this orchestrated thing in Dade County where aides to Tom DeLay, et cetera, were down there agitating this banging on the walls and intimidating people. If that had happened in Nicaragua, and it didn't actually, their elections were actually fairly clear. I mean, the U.S. would have been all over it and would have had some cause, but... you know, it is just astonishing that could happen without.
Well, that's a pretty well known part of the story, but about the congressional aides. But the part that I tell in Too Close to Call, and one of the, I mean, to me, most interesting part was the way the Bush campaign recruited the Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez, and their supporters, and how they sought to reassemble that coalition that was still so angry at the Clinton-Gore administration to protest about the recount. And it was very much a continuation of the Elian Gonzalez story, which led to the shutdown of the Miami recount.
Mm. Well, they've actually fixed their electoral system down there, but there doesn't seem to be any impetus to fix it here. In fact,
no, I mean, in fact, that's one of the most extraordinary things. Illinois had, in fact, a worse record of votes being discounted than Florida did, just that the elections weren't as close there, so it didn't matter. But, you know, the one point everyone agreed on after this whole fiasco was that we needed electoral reform. We needed to improve our technology and our voting procedures, and only one state in the union, and that's Florida to its credit, has done anything about this. And every other state has, you know, moved on to other things, and Congress has done nothing, and it's just shameful.
Well, we have an instance here, and this is, I guess, partisan or something, local parochial concern, that we have a guy running for Supreme Court here in Illinois who says that, well, it wasn't really necessary to do anything about it. I mean, he actually discounts the need for a fair and adequate vote, and I guess I'll say...
And it is not... I mean, the big problem with this issue is that the public has never been really exercised about it. I mean, you just don't have a mobilized constituency for improved voting machines. It's just something that never happens, and as a result, you get you get what you pay for.
I think the polls show people, as you say, there's no mobilized constituency for it, apparently, and I guess the Democrats should be faulted for that. I don't know. They don't want to upset Apple.
It's just not an issue that interests a lot. Sure, in answering a poll, people will say they're for reforming voting procedures and technology, but you know, when it comes to a legislature, that's not an issue where legislators feel much heat from their constituents, and that's what leads to what we have.
Take less than a B-1 bomber. Thanks.
Right. Well, that's it. This would, indeed was a question that I wanted to get at, and so it just to put a final point on it. It sounds as if you're saying that by the time the next presidential election rolls around, that the only place that there will have been any election reform probably would be the state of Florida.
Well, we have three years plus to go, so I don't want to write things off entirely. There are various proposals kicking around Congress that may, once Congress moves on to other issues after the war, may come back to life. But every state except Florida has done nothing so far. So we could be heading for this disaster yet again.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's authored several books, one about the trial of O.J. Simpson, another about the Clinton-Lewinsky story, and his most recent is about what happened in Florida in last year's presidential election. That book is called Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election, published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's another caller locally in Urbana, line one. Hello?
You're connecting elections and polls. I think that's a really good point because the voting, our elections, to be kind of loose and amenable, I can just imagine what happens with polls. But I've got a question. I haven't heard you or anybody else address it. Back in July, there was a article in the New York Times, and it was also picked up by a lot of other commentators. And the title of this one article was How Bush Took Florida, Mining the Overseas Absentee Vote by Barstow and Venata.
Right, yes, that's got a lot of publicity.
Well, have these recent reforms in Florida done something about this, the disparity of how they, approach the absentee vote? And what is your take on that whole issue? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I think the overseas absentee ballots and the military votes were a crucial part of this recount. And what happened was, in a nutshell, is that the Gore campaign geared up to challenge a lot of these ballots, just the way the Bush campaign was challenging votes in Palm Beach, saying that, what the Bush people kept saying is, if you're too stupid to vote and can't follow the rules, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. Well, the Gore people sought to apply that same principle to these military ballots, but that led to a storm of outrage that Gore was trying to disenfranchise, fighting men and women. And in a very important appearance on Meet the Press, Joe Lieberman, the vice presidential candidate, said, we're not going to challenge those votes. And it was a classic demonstration of the larger theme of Too Close to Call, which was that the ballots, which was that the Republicans were just much tougher, much more organized, much more ruthless than the Democrats were when it comes to fighting this recount. The New York Times report this summer was very interesting and sort of predictable, which was that as a result of failing to challenge these votes, hundreds of improper votes came in, and they overwhelmingly benefited the Bush campaign. Now, in fairness, it needs to be pointed out that the number of improper ballots, according to the Times survey, wasn't enough to make up the entire difference that Gore was behind, but it was a critical turning point in the election.
We'll go on. Another caller here. Another Urbana person, line two.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I would just, it seems to me like it's not really fair to, if you're going to, well, it seems to me like the, both the Florida Supreme Court and, you know, if you're going to call the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court partisan, then the Florida Supreme Court, in my view, was even more partisan. I mean, to overturn, you know, the state, Judge Saul, whatever his name was.
Judge Sauls.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think your view is shared by a lot of people, and partisanship is often in the eye of the beholder. You know, it ultimately comes down to what you think of these decisions on the merits. If you think they're defensible, if you think they're principled, then you don't think the judges are partisan. But
yeah, I also think that, you know, that I don't know if this is true or not. Isn't it easier to get on the Supreme Court or the state Supreme Court than it is the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure, it's easier. I mean, there are 50,
you know, to me,
state Supreme Courts, and there are only one U.S.
I guess for me it sounds like it's easier for party hacks to get control of a state Supreme Court than it would the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I think that's a, you know, I think, you know, the judges by and large are of lesser quality on the Florida Supreme Court, but this is, you know, because, but that's only in tribute to the U.S. Supreme Court. Those are
more prone to be partisan, would they not?
I think you can't make a generalization like that. It is true that in some states, Illinois, for example, judges are elected, which leads to a certain degree of hackdom. But Florida, they are appointed, and I think it's considered a pretty high-quality court, but it is also considered a pretty liberal court.
Are you a Democrat or Republican? And that's my last question.
Me?
Yeah.
I don't talk about my politics. I mean,
it's coming across that you really are a Democrat. It sounds like a sore loserman to me.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people believe that anyone who challenges the procedures here is a sore loser. I don't happen to believe that, but you are speaking undoubtedly for many people when you say that.
Okay, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Sure. Well, and I think that, I mean, just also in fairness to you, I think perhaps the earlier caller didn't hear it, but I did pose that question about partisanship in the case of both courts, and it sounded to me like you were saying, well, yeah, you certainly could look at it. Partisanship.
It's very much U.S. In the eye of the beholder, yeah. And certainly you're not going to get a confession from either any of the seven on the Florida Supreme Court or the nine on the U.S. Supreme Court. But I think, frankly, the U.S. Supreme Court's behavior here was pretty questionable.
We have someone on a car phone near Monticello, so we'll get them here in line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to sort of follow up on the last question by asking something kind of personal. I'm an author of four books in physics and computer science, and I always thought that when you wrote a book, it would last forever and it was better than articles that you might write in journals. And what I've found is that your book goes on the shelf and it stays there for a few months, and if it doesn't catch on, it either goes into remainders or just out of print. And I was wondering, and I think this might be of interest to people in an academic community like Champaign-Urbana, how do you feel about doing writing on current events in the sense that your work very quickly becomes either out of date or irrelevant? And what is the advantage of writing a book on a current event subject as opposed to writing journalistic types articles? So I'm sort of interested in how you feel about that as an author in a journalistic subject.
What an interesting question. That is an issue I thought about a lot, frankly. And what I try to do in my work, and I've done it with the Simpson case and impeachment and now with this recount, is try to walk the line between writing sort of in a contemporary account and writing something that will last for the ages. Frankly, I do care about writing on these subjects while interest is still strong and while it's still sort of part of the current events. But I also, you know, take great pride and pleasure in the fact that, you know, I'm not working on journalistic deadlines. I am taking my time. In fact, one of the things I always like to do, and in Too Close to Call, I had extraordinary cooperation, is, you know, during the 36 days, it's impossible to interview any of the protagonists, to interview James Baker. I mean, they are so involved in the day-to-day activities that they're not going to sit down and explain what they meant and what they were thinking and what they were trying to do. You know, I had terrific cooperation from people on all sides here explaining you know, in getting interviews to talk about what their thoughts were at various times. So, you know, it is true that when you write a book relatively quickly, you risk being immediately obsolete. But I also think, you know, you get to reflect a little more, certainly, or a lot more than you would in a journalistic account, and it's a pleasure.
Let's go to Bloomington, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
That's something that I talked with David about 2 months ago. And he may remember it, maybe not, I don't know. It was shortly after Bush's had said that he was going to root out evil and that it would take years. Well, he's supposed to come up for re-election in not too long from now. And if this war is going on, and he has promised to fight that war until all evil is removed from the earth, how is he going to be able to tie the hands of any possible successor, or does he intend to be president for life?
Well, I don't think he intends to be president for life. I think, look, no one knew this was all going to happen. I think to a great extent, this has been an improvisation for everyone. But I think it is clear it is accurate to say that he does not intend to be president forever.
Well, I think in a way, what the caller is asking or pointing out that suggesting that before we have seen in many cases where someone has been caught by overpromising, you know, making a promise that couldn't possibly be kept, or perhaps making a promise that they didn't keep. And I guess the question is, do you think that anything that Mr. Bush has said or done is likely to catch up with him when he is running for a second term?
Well, yes, I suppose it does. I mean, you know, the clear promise that he has made is that he wants to end terrorism of global reach. And if there are still terrorist activities that are plaguing our country, or then I think he's got a problem. But you know, I think even the most skeptical journalist has to point out that, or has to recognize that, this war, it seems, has been enormously successful so far, and we do appear to be on the verge of defeating the Taliban and thus immobilizing Al Qaeda. You know, whether that will succeed in winning the war on terrorism, I can't say for sure. But I think, you know, skeptics had better take note that they've done pretty darn well so far.
I'm still here, by the way.
Yes, sir.
And I have already spoken along the same line with David and his guests before. And I'm just wondering whether Bush intends to end this war with Afghanistan, or whether it will go on to other Islamic states.
Well, I couldn't really answer that. I don't know. I mean, I think that's obviously under active consideration. There does seem to be a constituency within the administration and within the country for going on to Iraq, but I think that's controversial, and I don't think the answer is clear about what's going to happen.
Well, I don't have much faith in the administration, so I don't know what's going to happen with them. Thank you for
everything.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, also legal analyst at ABC News. His new book is about last year's election battle in Florida. It's titled Too Close to Call. It's published by Simon & Schuster. No, that's somebody else. Random House.
Bite your tongue.
I'm sorry about that. My apologies to everyone concerned. We have a little time here. We have some other callers. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Champagne is the next caller. That's line three. Hello?
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I'd like to know your opinion about the Electoral College. Do you think there's a possibility that it'll ever be done away with, and do you think that it's appropriate today? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I think it's important to remember why the Electoral College came into existence, you know, when the Constitution was written at the turn of the 18th century, that at that point, the states were much more independent entities than they are now, and it was thought that a president to command a majority needed to command the support of states, not just individuals, not just voters, and that has really faded as a justification for the Electoral College, and frankly, it just remains as a kind of bizarre legacy of that period. But similarly, like the U.S. Senate, it is where each state, no matter how small, has two senators, is a representative of a time where small states have had a lot of power, and they don't like to give up that power. So I think it means that they are not they're not going to give it up anytime soon, and I don't think there is going to be any change in the Electoral College, even though it is pretty obsolete. Interestingly, Richard Nixon, who was no great liberal, was a great fan of getting rid of the Electoral College, but his effort failed to get it changed.
All right, and again, another caller here, Crystal Lake, line number one. Yeah. Hello.
It seems to me that since Gore got a half a million more votes than Bush, that the Electoral College should be outdated, and because he only won by one, Gore lost by one Electoral College vote only. But the thing on the election was, I think Florida had it all pre-planned to be intimidated to get the vote perfect. They had a governor, Bush in charge. They blocked people, the lower class people, from coming to vote, and those that had cards were turned to voting, registered voters were turned away, and so many things. They also had Catherine Harrison, and was both campaign manager and Secretary of State, and she announced the election, and a cousin did too. It seems to me it indicates that Florida's got a controlled vote.
And well, I mean, your skepticism is understandable, but I also think you got to be careful about some of these things. I think Catherine Harris, I mean, she's obviously a central figure in my book, and I think her performance was pretty disgraceful. I don't think there was an organized effort to disenfranchise black voters or poor voters, as you suggest. So I think some justification, some of these accusations have merit and some don't.
Did Governor Bush, Jeb, the president's brother, was he able to exercise any influence on his brother's behalf?
I do think there was some influence, but I don't. I think it was more subtle than just, you know, the governor calling the shots, saying who should win the election. I think the most important thing he did was put his network to work for his brother. He had lawyers around the state working for George W. When these controversies came up in each county, but it wasn't, and that was extremely valuable to the Republican campaign. But it wasn't like Jeb sort of did anything sinister or improper. It was just, you know, the fact that he was governor was just enormously important.
And just to hang in with Catherine Harris for a moment, she would it be correct to say that she used her position to benefit the Bush campaign, but did that within the boundaries of the law?
Well, actually, no. I think it was outside the boundaries of the law.
Okay.
I mean, one of the most startling things I learned in reporting Too Close to Call, I think, is, as I'm sure you remember, we heard from the Republican campaign over and over again that the votes have been counted and recounted. And that's because Florida law has a provision that says any election within 0.5% has to have an automatic recount. The ballots all have to be run through the machines in an automatic recount, and that's why you always heard that the ballots have been counted and recounted. Well, I learned that Catherine Harris's office never ordered the recount of a full quarter of the ballots in the state. Over 1 million ballots have never been recounted to this day because the Harris office didn't want to take the chance that that would turn the election around. Now, I think that's pretty sinister and pretty, but I think it's characteristic of how she ran this campaign.
Could the Gore campaign have made more of an issue of her?
They could have. In fact, one of the behind-the-scenes struggles I talk about is there were several lawyers on the Gore campaign that wanted to subpoena her, that wanted to call her as a witness in some of these court hearings. But again, the cautious Gore team decided ultimately that that was too provocative and decided not to call her as a witness.
Just the book is full of kinds of interesting little side notes. I'm just thinking, you talked about the fact that, for example, on the Republican side, they were interested in trying to mobilize the relatives of Elian Gonzalez, who certainly had a grudge against the Clinton administration, and get them to, in a sense, agitate and in favor of the Republicans. The thing I'm thinking about is that Gal Gore was thinking about trying to recruit Aaron Brockovich,
right,
to Florida.
You had just such a crazy cast of characters here. Is that, you know, Gore was thinking about maybe they would have a lawsuit in Palm Beach, and they would have to organize a lot of plaintiffs. And Gore said, I know, I saw that movie. Aaron Brockovich motivated a lot of plaintiffs to get involved. And so we called her twice to talk about her coming to Florida. But when his aides got wind of it, they said, look, this election has enough material for stand-up comedians as it is. Let's not make it worse.
I guess for a lot of people, the bottom line in all of this is this, that at this point, does it still matter?
Well, George Bush is the president. He's the commander-in-chief of the military, and you get no dispute from me on that. But history always matters, and I think a cold, clear look at this election is something that I did and will be done by historians for generations to come. And in a directly practical sense, you know, we are, I hope, going to be having elections in this country for eternity. And the question is, are we going to have procedures like the ones in Florida to govern them? And if that's true, I think that would be a pretty disappointing outcome for America. So I think there's always a lot to learn, and I think the story very much still matters.
Well, there we will leave it. Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and the book, if you would like to read it, is Too Close to Call. It's published by Random House.